program, and one of those was to not negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. They had an incredible amount of buying power. The idea that you would be buying for how many million Americans?
Off the top of my head, no, but many millions.
Tens of millions of older Americans would be bargaining on behalf of their entire annual drug expense. And rather than use that to get a decent deal, which is what the U.S. Veterans Administration does, which is what, Medicaid already had been doing to some extent, using that buying power, they decided that that would interfere with pharmaceutical company profits, literally, and they chose not to. And instead, they would divide that huge group up into hundreds and hundreds of little insurance pools, which would then supposedly pool their negotiating ability. But it's sort of a joke, because if you passed up the big negotiating power and then pretended that you were aggregating these little negotiating powers, just to me, it never added up. And the key was that they were going to be spending money, a lot of money, taxpayer money, but they didn't want to get the best deal for the buck. And so if you're looking at a donut hole today and you're a senior in this country and you're having to pay that couple thousand out of pocket, just remember that you're paying that because the crafters of this bill did not want to cut into pharmaceutical companies' profits. And some of them went on to work for the industry. Am I right?
That's correct. You know, it's pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies who work together on this. And in fact, the term, the donut hole notion, the whole idea of the donut hole came from one of the senators who did not support this bill and said, you know, essentially the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies got the donuts and we're getting stuck with the hole. And that's really where it came, you know, the whole idea of donut hole and donut hole day ultimately came from. And so we wanted to, you know, and this was something that we were doing here in Oregon, but also this was happening across the country. We wanted to not only focus on the donut hole and the coverage gap and the problems that have occurred up to this point, but what can we do to fix this?
That's an excellent question. Actually, I remember that we had one of our local Democratic representatives, David Wu, voted for it in the middle of the night, and you know, it was let's just say a highly unusual situation where he'd been told repeatedly by every interest group that ever showed an interest in caring for older people or sicker people and so forth, poor people, don't vote for this turkey. He voted for it in the middle of the night. But what he said at the time was he was going to come back and fix it. Now, I don't know if he's shown leadership in trying to fix it, but what are the fixes that some in Congress are looking at right now?
Well, I'm not sure. I know that he's working on one thing. There are a number of them that are starting to develop in Congress right now. Congresswoman Hooley in particular has really taken a leadership role on this. And she's working on a number of bills. In fact, she actually, I got it right here. She filed a discharge petition on one specific bill, H.R. 376, which is Medicare's Equitable Drugs for Seniors Act. And it would repeal the prohibition on the Department of Health and Human Services from negotiating for lower drug prices. So things are actually starting to happen there. And like I said, we decided on during this last week, we wanted to call attention to the problems, but more than that, call attention to what we can do going forward. So there are things that are happening at the federal level. There are some things that people can take advantage of here in the state of Oregon. For example, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which is an amazing little program that was created by the 2003 legislature and allows people of a certain group, 54 and older, 185% of the federal poverty level, and no private prescription coverage for the last 6 months, to join this purchasing pool. So Oregon actually has the beginnings of a purchasing pool right now. And we also got a waiver with Medicare so that seniors who are in Part D and meet the other qualifications can also use their Oregon prescription drug card. They can enroll, and that is something that will really help them get through the coverage gap. They just need to be, keep careful records and all of that, but they can use that card along with their Medicare Part D.
And where's some place that people can go to get this kind of information to find out more and maybe if they decide to get involved?
We have a lot of stuff on our website. We did a whole section on Donut Hole Day and things that you can do.
Why don't you share that with us? What's your website?
It's www.OregoniansForHealthSecurity.org.
OregonianSforHealthSecurity.org. Of course, I have a special place in my heart for that organization because our fellow labor radio host, Mary Beth Healy, is one of the folks involved in that. But that's not why I had on the show tonight. It happens that last week was sort of a hallmark for American seniors. They started to really feel the pain of that donut hole.
Yeah.
Jennifer Warren, I want to thank you for joining us tonight on Labor Radio.
Thank you so much, Don.
We've been talking with Jennifer Warren of Oregonians for Health Security about the donut hole. We turn now to the third segment of our hour-long program. That's Daniel Gross, who I understand is waiting online on the phone. Are you there, Daniel?
Good to be with you, Don.
Thanks again for coming back. Actually, we had you on the show, if I'm not mistaken, in July of 2004. Things were looking better at that time. You are a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and you were active in a campaign to unionize Starbucks coffee in Manhattan. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right, Don. And actually now the campaign has never been more spirited or energetic. Since we've spoken, the campaign has expanded from one store to seven Starbucks stores in New York. And just recently now we've expanded to Chicago.
But you're not you're no longer a barista, and not by choice.
That's right. On August 5th of this year, Starbucks finally did the dirty deed. We were waiting for them to make their move for some time. And they did it, a very crude maneuver. I actually had engaged in a protest in support of another member of our union who was being investigated on trumped-up charges at work, and the IWW called the protest. And we called for Evan not to be fired. It was a very simple, kind of run-of-the-mill protest.
Your typical don't fire our coworker protest outside the boss's office.
Right. I didn't think much about it until I was brought to the back of the store where I worked by a Starbucks partner and asset protection investigator named Mark Stella, who proceeded to interrogate me about the event and explain that Starbucks was alleging that I had threatened Evan's district manager if she was going to go ahead and terminate Evan. It was absolutely ridiculous.
I like the title, though.
Starbucks baristas could attest, but of course the investigation never interviewed those eyewitnesses.
Can you tell again that title? I like the title. Of the investigator? Yeah.
The partner and asset protection investigator.
And were you a partner or an asset?
That's a good question.
I they decided you weren't and got rid of you.
It depends on your perspective.
Right.
So in any event, that interrogation notified me, at least, to the presence of investigation of my activities at that protest. And a week later, the investigation concluded and Starbucks notified me that they had found that I had threatened the district manager, which is an offensive lie, and that I was terminated.
I saw a picture of you actually on an online article. I didn't think you seemed that threatening, but I haven't been in person with you, so did you get in his face?
Oh, absolutely not. It couldn't have been more run-of-the-mill. The district manager was joined by some other senior managers to come to the store to surveil union members' activity. That's Starbucks' MO, to pack management into stores to intimidate workers from exercising their right to organize. And as the district manager was walking into the store, I simply asserted my belief that it wouldn't be the right thing to do to fire Evan. It was the kind of mutual aid that, at least on paper, has been protected in this country for over 70 years.
That's right, and we talked about that earlier in tonight's program, actually. I want to maybe take a step back, too, and just give a little context for those who may not remember the 2004 broadcast. Starbucks is an enormous corporation that is a little bit unusual in that it owns its coffee outlets. It's not a franchise for the most part. There's a few very small exceptions, actually. One of them is worth mentioning is that locally here in the Portland area, as an example, there are some Starbucks kiosks in some Albertsons and Safeway stores. Some of those folks actually are represented by a union, but they're not technically Starbucks employees. They're employees of the Albertsons and Safeway. They just got the green Starbucks uniform and so forth. But otherwise, I think there's something like 10,000 Starbucks stores in the world, in the United States, none of them are formally recognized as having a union. And I think there might be a reason to that. Of course, they say, when I called them several years ago to do a story, they say that the reason is that the associates are happy because they have above minimum wage, flexible hours, which is nice, because they're maybe part-time, but significantly that they have benefits. They're very well known for that, having benefits for part-time workers, but basically health care and other kinds of benefits. So why on earth did you want to form a union there in Manhattan at Starbucks?
Well, because the company's message is, frankly, a pack of lies. There's just no other way to put it. As you correctly point out, the benefit story is Starbucks' hallmark. You know, the IWW looked around and we saw our members either uninsured or on Medicaid, or if we're lucky, having health care from another source, or really pinching pennies to afford the company's health care. So we started pressuring Starbucks and we said, look, you've anointed yourself the leader of employee health care. Chairman Howard Schultz is feted on Capitol Hill because you're a leader in employee health care. At least do what Walmart has done and release the percentage of your workers who are covered by company health care. Quite simple statistic. The company wouldn't do that, but what they did release was the percentage of its workers and managers who are covered by company health care. That percentage that they released is 42% of the workforce covered by company health care. Not only is that worse than the industry average, it's worse than Walmart.
Now, what do you mean? I'm sorry, what do you mean industry average? I mean, coffee shops aren't known as generous employers, unless I'm mistaken.
Oh, no, they're absolutely not, but I don't know the exact number. It's in the range of 44 or 45% workers insured. It's actually better than Starbucks. This is Starbucks' own figure, which they released to the Wall Street Journal and then confirmed with the journal in a subsequent news article that was the correct figure. Once again, the real figure is even lower if you take out the managers who are better able to afford the health care. The hurdles to health care at Starbucks are twofold. One, you have to work 240 hours in a quarter to get the health care. Now, keep in mind that every single Starbucks barista in the United States is part-time with no guaranteed hours per week. So it's not assured by any means that you can get the 240 hours. Now, even if you do qualify, there's the co-pays, the premiums, and other out-of-pocket expenses, which is very difficult to pay when you're not getting guaranteed hours and you're making $6, $7, or $8 an hour, depending on where you are in the country. And, you know, that's one of the reasons the company is waging this vicious anti-union campaign, for which they were cited by the labor board in a landmark settlement. You know, they don't want workers to have an independent voice to challenge these kind of issues that we face every day at work.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to Labor Radio. We're talking with Daniel Gross, until recently a barista at a Manhattan Starbucks and a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. Daniel Gross, so I think you know, you've sort of made the point that one of the reasons you would want a union is to make Starbucks' promises about you know, decent health benefits and so forth real for you and your coworkers. Now, how did you go about forming the union, and what has prevented you from succeeding at least in getting, you know, like legal recognition just yet?
But let me say, you know, recognition is not of a concern for us. For example, I don't have to ask to be recognized as a human being. A union is a group of workers united to address issues on the job. And as union members, we've been able to chalk up some important gains on the job. For example, we've won 3 wage increases. We've bumped the starting wage up from $7.75 in New York to $8.75. through direct action on the job and in the community. We are now getting more secure hours for our members, although Starbucks still refuses to acknowledge to guarantee any number of hours per week. We've also remedied a host of individual grievances that workers have had with management in a whole wide variety of issues. We've taken on rat and insect infestation in New York stores, and we've had a good measure of success in that area. We've taken on religious discrimination. We've taken on scheduling problems successfully, where workers were scheduled for the closing shift and then scheduled for the opening shift the next day, and after the commute weren't able to sleep and were having negative health effects from that. So it's really a testament to the widespread discontent of workers at the company, and also the determination that workers feel in their efforts to achieve an independent voice on the job. You know, Starbucks likes to talk about, you know, the material so-called benefits of working there, And, you know, as I pointed out, and, you know, people should check out the website, StarbucksUnion.org, and we successfully debunk all the myths. But, you know, unions are about more than bread and butter. Unions are how we can interact with the global social justice movement. Unions are how Starbucks workers were able to interact with the May 1st general strike in this country, which was a historic moment. And unions are about workers having their own independent voice, so we can speak out about, you know, what we face at work, and it's not just management's voice that's heard.
And it strikes me as a way also to sort of reclaim some dignity, you know, the autonomy and respect. You know, you can't push me around. I have my union brothers and sisters to back me up, which is what you're saying. Basically, in your case, in the IWW in Manhattan, some of you did get a little bit squeaky together and support each other and had some modest gains. Of course, at this point recently, maybe they decided they did not like the sound of the squeak and have gone after you. They say that you were maybe unpleasant to a manager and insufficient partner, like you say, you were fired for supporting a union, and you filed a legal charge with the National Labor Relations Board. Now they investigate those. Have they looked into your case yet?
The investigation is taking place, and we're very confident that we'll prevail in the legal arena. But the only way to prevail ultimately in this effort is grassroots pressure on the ground, and solidarity between Starbucks workers, other workers, and community members. You know, let me tell you that this company, I can tell you from personal experience, is waging a vicious anti-union campaign. In addition to my termination, three other baristas are currently terminated for union activity and fighting to get our jobs back. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more. There's threats, people being threatened with job loss or wages going down if they support the union. There's massive surveillance, intense propaganda, captive audience meetings, course of 101 meetings. I mean, this company is Walmart. I mean, people have to understand that, yes, it's clear that Starbucks, I would argue, is probably the single greatest organization in the history of corporations when it comes to PR and their employment message, but they are waging the Walmart union busting campaign. In fact, Starbucks union busting law firm, Akin Gump, has a partner that serves on Walmart's board, and Starbucks CEO, Jim Donald, comes out of the Walmart stable of executives. So folks hopefully know, or if they don't, please get engaged, because this company does not deserve your hard-earned money, and the only way we're going to be able to keep building on our gains and building membership is for folks in their community to reach out to baristas, to protest, to get involved. And, you know, Portland has a very vibrant IWW branch, a phenomenal group of folks there who are waiting with open arms for any barista that's interested in getting organized and for community members who want to plug in and support the organizing drive at Starbucks.
I happen to know, actually, also going back a few years, there was an attempt, actually some success, in Vancouver, British Columbia, in a group of Starbucks there, where workers joined a rather progressive union called the Canadian Auto Workers. They had some initial success. It was quite a difficult campaign. They had something called the Unstrike, where they basically went to work, but maybe didn't wear the company uniform or wore a union button or something to that effect. This went on for quite a while, but they eventually got their first union contract with some real improvements. Came back a few years later and was much more difficult to get the contract. And as far as I know, a third time around, they never got their contract and was sort of frozen out. One of the things Starbucks did is they took those increases that they gave to the union folks and decided to give to everyone in the region those same increases. And so, in a way, I suppose if you were a non-union Starbucks worker in Vancouver, British Columbia, you'd say, well, why should I join the union? And they're going to give me the same thing anyway. So I think, you know, through that and other methods, I think they were pretty successful up there. And of course, Canada has much more, you know, the labor laws there are actually much more favorable to unions than certainly than the United States labor laws are. Have you found U.S. labor law to be of any help to you so far?
U.S. labor law is non-existent except to support the managerial interests. I mean, it would be a joke if it wasn't so sad. I mean, the election system is broken beyond all repair, which is why we don't get involved in elections. And we've had better success with unfair labor practices. We do file ULPs, but we're quick to point out that the legal piece is one small part of a much larger grassroots direct action strategy. We know that we're not going to get justice in capitalist courts. That being said, as one tool, you know, we do use the ULPs, but labor law in the United States is broken beyond repair, probably, which is why it's so important for workers to try to build solidarity while steering clear of the law, as my good friend Stoughton Lind pointed out in a book title of a book he wrote.
Daniel Gross, regardless of that, which I hear what you're saying, I do hope that you'll prevail and get some vindication within that legal process, where, you know, all the world can be declared that the federal government says you were fired for union sympathies, and that you basically would, they'd force you to return to Starbucks and maybe get some back pay. And in any case, I want to wish you and all of all the others there success in what you're doing.
It's always great to be with you, and once again, I want to throw out the website, if I may.
Absolutely.
www.starbucksunion.org.
Daniel Gross, thanks for joining us tonight on Labor Radio once again.
Thank you.
We've been talking again with Daniel Gross, who was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, still is a member, but was also working at Starbucks in Manhattan until recently. The company decided that they didn't want him. To be continued. Actually, since we're talking about the law, how convenient and appropriate that we now have joining us by phone Mark Griffin, an attorney here in Portland who's defending rather successfully, hopefully, a group of custodians. Mark, are you with us?
I am here.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So, Mark, you are perhaps the lead attorney. There's several attorneys involved, but in a case that's now in the U.S. federal court about whether the custodians will get back pay. And maybe we should go back a few years for folks who just moved to Portland or don't remember. 4 years ago, Portland Public Schools decided that it was going to take a look at its finances and balance them on the backs of the custodians. At least the salaries that the union custodians made had become inconvenient, and they were all fired and replaced by some private contractors who made quite a bit less. That was their scheme to make money. At the time, several attorneys said, well, but excuse us, that's against the law. It turns out there's this little-known custodial civil service law that the district didn't count on. The attorneys told them they ought to wait and see what happens in the courts. District decided not to wait. It turns out then, of course, the Oregon Supreme Court last December said it was against the law. And they're being returned now, as we speak, they're now in the schools, cleaning the schools, but they're waiting for a final resolution to their case. Have they had even an apology, Mark Griffin?
Well let me correct you on one thing.
Absolutely.
The custodian civil service law may have been little known to many people in the community, but it was well known to the school board. At the time that they terminated these custodians, they were targeting this law and trying to essentially abrogate it, get rid of it,
or find maybe a way around it. They were saying, well, these folks, the contracted employees, weren't employees, and therefore it didn't apply. And the law basically said, well, folks cleaning the schools at Portland Public Schools had to go through civil service procedures to get hired and disciplined, and they had, you know, there was sort of a progressive era law to protect the system against cronyism and all sorts of abuses. All of a sudden becomes very, very important in a case against contracting out.
That's true, and again, I think that the law dates to the mid-30s when certainly issues of many civil service laws came into effect at that time, and one of the concerns was the idea of public contracts for private contractors. That certainly was something that was well on the minds of legislators back in the 30s and even before. As a matter of fact, one of the first initiatives in Oregon had to do with public contracts for private contractors.
But so the Supreme Court basically said this was illegal, and that set in motion this case which had lain dormant, which is your case. You're saying that if it's illegal, then they, by golly, are going to be owed back pay because the district wronged them, no fault of their own. They had no complaint with the custodians, presumably, just that they were paid too much, and they fired them because of that. Now, basically, what's going to happen meantime with the wages they didn't earn?
Well, there are a number of cases pending. There are two in the state court system and the Court of Appeals. There's also one in the Federal District Court, which is a civil rights violation based upon the proposition that the due process rights of the custodians were violated because they had a property interest, what's known as a property interest, in their jobs, and they were illegally terminated. the Oregon Supreme Court has clearly stated that contracting out for services was illegal under Oregon law. So by extension, then, firing someone to contract out someone else is an illegal termination and violates due process rights.
But evidently the school district doesn't agree to this yet, and they're saying that they don't owe back pay. They've obviously complied with the Supreme Court decision, at least to the extent that they've offered reinstatement and have rehired many of the custodians, but they're still saying they don't owe any damages.
They certainly are fighting that fight. That they publicly they're saying they don't owe any wages. But typically in an employment case, if someone is illegally terminated from employment, one of the remedies that they get is back pay for the money that they lost as a result of the illegal termination.
How much is at stake here? What kind of dollar amounts do you think we're talking about?
I couldn't tell you exactly. I do represent approximately 275 people who lost their jobs, and those were family wage jobs. Many of those people, unfortunately, were not able to replace those jobs with similarly paying jobs. So it's a substantial amount of money. It's more than the school district saved or claims they saved. There's still some doubt as to whether they saved any money in doing this, in my mind.
Well, particularly if they end up having to pay back pay, it would seem to me that they wouldn't save the money because they're paying all the salary plus all the legal bills, which are quite substantial, many hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think, per year to fight this and continuing to this day. You know, not to mention various other, you know, it all adds up, but they sold their equipment to the company and now they're having to buy equipment, apparently. You know, at the outside, I think the figure of $60 million has been put out there because if you took the entire compensation of the group, you know, that was fired 4 years ago, in 4 years' time, they would have earned, you know, basically $60 million. Of course, they've earned some wages in the meantime. Some of them actually ended up getting better jobs and probably didn't want to come back. But many of them were not able to find better jobs, but found some job. And so they've sort of whatever dollars they earned in the meantime basically are going to be taken out of that award. Is that right?
But whatever, generally what happens in these kinds of cases is that if you earn income during the period of time when you're illegally off of work, there's an offset for the amount of income that you made during that period of time, yes.
Right. But so it can't be more than $60 million, although it's quite a large sum, but it, you know, may very well, I'm just speculating here, be more than $15, $20 million, you know, a very large amount, and certainly more than the district counted on saving, in fact, during that time.
It will be more than the district claims that it saved.
Right, right.
The district essentially was gambling with public money.
Do you think this should affect how voters vote on the upcoming property tax for the public schools? I mean, should they punish the district for how they treated the custodians, or is there some flaw to that?
I don't think that punishing the district does anybody any good. The bottom line, and as the Supreme Court stated in its opinion on this, the bottom line is the custodians are there because for the safety of the children. And I'm not in a position to say that the people who made this mistake or made this decision, let's say, are no longer on the board and are no longer superintendents. There certainly is no reason to punish the people who are there now, and it's certainly no reason to punish the school children in this district.
I think those would be the folks who would be punished. But I just think it's one of these frustrating things. You see these kinds of decisions, and hopefully it's died down, actually, with the new regime at Portland Public Schools. But, you know, for years we were seeing headlines about, the expensive golden parachutes of folks that, you know, got hired, and then they were fired for some reason, and, you know, the district was paying our tax dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars of that, and so forth, and various, expensive, unsuccessful schemes, it seems like, have been associated with the district. That may be a drop in the bucket, and it may be that the district's financial problems pale in comparison, but I think people remember that and then sort of maybe want to hold it against the district or just say, well, they're not spending our money wisely, so why vote for it? I guess it's all going to be playing out here in the next month or so, electoral.
Well, whether this board and this superintendent spends money wisely is something that we'll find out fairly quickly with respect to these lawsuits, whether or not, but that begs the issue of whether or not this particular regime, as you say, is should be punished for the misconduct of the prior regime, and really it was they violated the law.
I do
how they should be accountable and how to what extent they should be accountable is something I suppose the courts will decide.
Yeah, I do want to get to sort of like where this case is headed in just a second, but before we leave the blame game, I want to know, can we blame Ron Saxon for this?
You would have to ask someone who has more information than I do about that. The question becomes, where was this idea? And it was really an idea, although it was an idea to bust the unions. Let's not kid ourselves about this. It was an idea to bust the unions. It was always portrayed as an idea to save money, but I think it was an idea to bust the unions. And the people who were involved in it, including Steve Goldschmidt and other people, obviously were there to bust unions. And I think that if you talk to the teachers' union or any other union that's involved with these individuals, you can see there was a very hostile attitude toward unions in 2002 and before.
Right. In fact,
so the question is, and I suppose you could answer it as an investigative journalist, was this idea concocted when Ron Saxon was on the school board?
Well, that's what I'm thinking, because he was one of the seven members of the school board, and you know, a little bird tells me that he was part of a mass conspiracy to hire Steve Goldschmidt and get the unions busted. I mean, I'm sort of exaggerating, but you never know.
But
as it turns out, the entire board that voted to contract out, they're all now gone as well, as is the administrators, as you mentioned. So it's a whole new cast. For better or worse, they're probably worse. They're still fighting this fight in the courts against you guys, but obviously they've been forced to do the right thing in terms of returning these folks who, you know, for no fault of their own, were fired after, you know, many cases, decades of service, holding keys and making sure the kids were okay.
Correct. They are being forced to do the right thing.
We just have maybe a minute left in our program tonight. I want to know, what can people expect? Is this going to be years working its way through the courts, or what's your prediction?
I don't expect that it's going to be years working through the court. We're working diligently now to gather as much information as we can on the amount of damages that the individual custodians to which they're entitled. So we're trying to work it through the court system as quickly as we can. Whether or not the school district is going to try and delay that, the inevitable or not, is a question I suppose is going to be resolved within the next 6 months.
Mark Griffin, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. For those folks who maybe would be very interested in learning a lot more, can we direct them to that website of yours?
Certainly, PortlandCustodians.com.
PortlandCustodians.com. You can find the entire history of this case. It's actually, for I don't know, legal geeks or justice geeks or something. It might be an interesting read. PortlandCustodians.com. And Mark, I'd also like to see if we can get you back at some point in the near future. You, amongst your labor law activities, also represent the farm workers out in very interesting cases in eastern Oregon at, it's called, I think, Three Mile Dairy Farms, am I right?
Three Mile Canyon Farms,
yes, excuse me.
Columbia River Dairy, yes. My partner and I represent people out there.
And actually, they're sort of in an exciting phase in their campaign after several years of trying to get United Farm Workers Union out in this very large dairy. I think 300 plus workers, maybe up to 600. They're actually at the point where the farm has agreed to recognize them on the basis of signed cards if they can gather them by, I think, mid-December. So
I think that's true. They've, as I understand it, they've agreed to a card check policy for selection of collective bargaining unit.
Mark Griffin, I want to thank you once again for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
We've been talking again with Mark Griffin, attorney. Check that out, PortlandCustodians.com. That's about all the time we've got. I want to thank you for listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I'm Don McIntosh. I'd like to thank our engineer, Ben Levine, and our guests, Tom Chamberlain, Jennifer Warren, Daniel Gross, and who we just had on, Mark Griffin. We hope you'll tune in again the following Monday at 6 p.m. for Labor Radio. The topic is The Race for Top Teamster. Host Bill Zimmerman talks with Portland union leader Tom Leadham about Leadham's candidacy for president of the 1.4 million member Teamsters Union, America's largest private sector union. The incumbent, Jimmy Hoffa Jr., has also been invited to appear. Again, that's next Monday at 6 o'clock. Next up, stay tuned for Time Sound, a program of soul music with host Kevin Berry.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.